This land is your land. This land is my land.
Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. We're a venue of spoken word presentations in many forms. We feature writers, artists, storytellers, and thinkers recorded at events around Seattle. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In 1789, Thomas Jefferson wrote this in a letter to Thomas Paine.
I consider trial by jury as the only anchor ever yet imagined by man by which a government can be held to the principles of its constitution.
That sentiment begs the question, would Jefferson recognize the United States justice system today? 97% of criminal cases in the U.S. result in plea bargains. Pleas that do not determine guilt or innocence. Only 3% go to trial by jury. How did the Sixth Amendment guarantee of a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury in all criminal prosecutions, with the assistance of counsel, become an anachronism? Seattle attorney Kelly Vomaka has answers to these questions. She's a criminal defense lawyer with extensive knowledge of how plea deals work. Vomaka spoke at the 7th Annual Smoke Farm Symposium on Saturday, August 22, 2015. Smoke Farm is a program center and events venue run by the Seattle-based nonprofit organization Rubicon Foundation. The farm is located north of Arlington on the banks of the Stillaguamish River. Kelly Vomaka is a graduate of the University of Puget Sound and Seattle University. She founded Solanus Casey Legal Services and is working on a book about legal jurisdiction. Symposium curators Stuart Smithers and Brendan Kiley introduced the talk.
I'm Stuart Smithers, and I'm the co-host with Brendan Kiley. And I'm also the titular president of the Rubicon Foundation that owns Smoke Farm. And it actually was set up for Smoke Farm. It was sort of contemporaneous with the purchase of the farm, which is a long, interesting story and saga. Holding on to it as well. But here we are. We did hold on to it, and we started these symposia. Is that the right word? It sounds very academic and correct. So this is the seventh one, right? So we're really happy to have you all here. The idea, Brendan and I sort of thought it would be great to have a gathering like this, and then it gradually became sort of this TED Talks in a barn idea, but of course without the censorship that TED Talks have, and then last year it was dubbed a sort of neo-Marxist TED Talks in a barn, which kind of went with the sunrise this morning, this sort of strange apocalyptic red sun that came out of the sky because of the forest fire smoke that's blowing in, right? So in any case, we're really happy that you're here. So I would like to hand things over now to Brendan, who will be a more coherent and charming host.
I doubt that very much. Welcome, everyone. The first speaker today is Kelly Vomaka, who has been a practicing attorney for 25 years. For 10 years, she was a public defender, handling all kinds of cases across the spectrum, felonies, misdemeanors, 3 murder trials, and worked a great deal in the King County Juvenile Court. And she opened her own practice in 2013 and began thinking about what she calls trauma-informed juvenile defense. She says that there's a vanguard of lawyers who are in the minority now, but it might be a growing movement, who see law is actually, in a sense, a healing profession. That when people come to you with criminal law, with family law, with immigration issues, they're actually in the middle of a very big crisis. And she did some training in what effects trauma has on the brain, and specifically what effects trauma has on the adolescent brain, which is a whole different ball of wax. And just yesterday morning, she was in juvenile drug court. And 2.5 years ago, she says, she began to think more seriously about how common it is that people have to plead guilty to get out of jail. She had an adult client that she was talking to about this, and then the next day she was trying to explain it to a 15-year-old client, and he just didn't understand. It didn't make sense. And she said, when you can't explain something like that to a 15-year-old, something is deeply wrong. And one of the things that she's heard people say over the years is just because he pled guilty doesn't mean he did it, and just because the case was dismissed doesn't mean he didn't do it. So now to talk about Plea Nation and how that works in terms of our criminal justice system, please welcome Kelly Vomacka.
Hi, I'm Kelly Vomacka. In just a moment, there will be slides behind me. See, here they come. The specter from the deep. I'm here to talk about a topic. It's not in the least bit common amongst lawyer circles. I'm a lawyer. I do it every day. There are things lawyers talk about that normal people don't really think about, but this is not something even lawyers really think about. So I thought it's a great opportunity, a great audience to just explore, I think, what might be kind of an unusual idea. So it's about plea bargaining. So I'm going to start here to get into the topic. The first is something that not even lawyers really think about, and probably lay people don't really either. What is the fundamental purpose of the criminal justice system? Like, why do we have it? We spend billions of dollars a year. There's a lot of emotional and social capital we spend on it. Why are we doing it? And I'm going to suggest to you, I can let you ponder that, but I'm going to suggest to you an answer, which is that fundamentally what we're doing is separating the guilty from the innocent. We are identifying guilty people and punishing them appropriately. We are identifying innocent people who've gotten caught up wrongfully, and extracting them from the system. That's the fundamental purpose. And what I'm here to say is that while that may be what we think is the mission of the criminal justice system, that is not in fact what we're doing. What we are in fact doing is a completely different mission, which I'll get to what I think that is in a few minutes. But in fact, what we're doing is not so much separating, we're not really separating the sheep from the goats. Here are some examples. What we think when the system goes wrong, we think about either the guilty going free, here's O.J. Simpson, or the innocent being either punished or even killed. So here are the Scottsboro Boys. All right, Scottsboro Boys, John Gotti, Teflon Don, the Rosenbergs, 200 people whose names you don't know who've been exonerated mainly through DNA testing in the last 20 years or so. The Angola Three are in the news these days. Here's George Zimmerman. Here's Jamise Wilson. Now the number is actually, it's a new edition of that report, 250 exonerated. Here's Ray Rice last year. Here's some guy whose name I don't know, but I just absolutely love that picture. I think he's just been exonerated. So these are what we often think of as examples of the system doing something wrong. And in fact, this is the system working as we've designed it, in my opinion. So we are not separating the sheep from the goats. Here's what happens in a typical case. I know I'm not speaking to lawyers, and you probably don't think about this. So some of what you think is happening is actually happening. And some of it's probably different than what your impression is. So fundamentally, here's what's happening. Let's say one of two things happens initially in a criminal case. Bad guys, such as Butch and Sundance here, commit a crime. They're guilty, they commit a crime, they get caught or shot, but we won't go quite that far. Or some innocent person gets caught up in the criminal justice system, and here's Richard Kimball. Either way, they are brought before the criminal justice system with its, blind justice, weighing the scales of justice, and I don't think that ideal is quite where we are. But this is what we think is happening. Everyone's brought equally before the law, and there's one system that processes everyone through and hopefully does it accurately. So here's a trial, just a generic trial. When we think about what law is, what lawyers do, what you see on TV, what you read about in the newspapers, what you think about are trials, I think. What you think lawyers doing every single day is just going to trial. What is a trial? So they're brought before the judge, there's a jury, there's jury selection, you've probably been called for jury duty at some point. Evidence is presented, lawyers make speeches, judges make legal rulings, eventually the jury goes back to the jury room and either 45 minutes later or 4 weeks later comes back with a verdict. And that's the answer. And then depending on that answer, there's some sort of sentencing. Has anyone actually been a juror here, actually done it? Yeah, look at that, that's awesome. Was it one of the best experiences of your entire life? No. Well, some people love it, really. And some people, it's hard and they carry it with them. Anyone actually been a witness? I won't ask why you were a witness, but you've sat on the jury, on the witness stand. Yeah, it's a hard thing to do. So what you think of as happening in a trial, that really is about what's happening. I mean, what you see on TV generally is what's happening, other than the lawyers are not nearly so articulate as they are on TV, and it never happens the same afternoon the guy got arrested. I mean, there's a long preparation time before a trial. But basically, that is what a trial is. So what I'm here to say is not that that vision is wrong, but only that it's very rare. It almost never happens. What happens instead is plea bargaining. And I'm not here, there's people who hear that word and think immediately, they have some vision immediately of what whether plea bargaining is a good thing or a bad thing. I personally think as a lawyer of 25 years, I like it. I do it a lot. I think there's a lot of good reasons for it. I'll explain why in a minute. But I'm not actually here to say whether it's good or bad. I'm here to say that it is overwhelmingly common. It's just what we're actually doing with the system. So someone yesterday was saying they hate charts. So here's my only chart. I apologize to that person. I love charts. So this is a chart of the prevalence of plea bargaining, how many cases get resolved without going to trial. As you can see, it's always been quite high. And it's been getting higher and higher and higher. When I was in law school, it was something like 93%, and now we're up to 97% of cases resolved by plea bargain. And I think it's just going up and up. I mean, but already 97% is pretty darn high. This is just the federal criminal courts, but the state numbers are very comparable. If that was Greek to you, there's two different legal systems, the federal and the state, and they just operate separately, but similar things do happen in this case. 4 years ago now, there was a U.S. Supreme Court case, Lafler v. Cooper. Here's the actual blurb from the opinion. And Justice Kennedy now, said, as you can see, the position ignores the reality that criminal justice today is for the most part a system of pleas and not a system of trials. 97% of federal convictions are pleas, and it actually says, I think it's 94 state courts are pleas. Anyway, it's not a system of trials, it's a system of pleas. And that's what I think is unrecognized. That's what lawyers don't even talk about. I sure don't see that being discussed in the general press or, you know, among people who think about things. In this case, the issue essentially was you have a right when you go to trial to have your lawyer be more than some idiot with a bar card. They have to actually be a good lawyer. They don't have to be a genius, but they have to be constitutionally adequate. We've had situations where the lawyer was drunk, and turns out that's not such good advocacy. So in this case, the question was, does your lawyer need to be constitutionally adequate during plea bargaining? Because is plea bargaining so important that the constitutional right attaches to that stage? Or do they only have to be a good trial lawyer? Yeah. So here's some poor guy signing his plea paperwork. This is what, when I think of going to court, this is largely what happens. This is what happened Friday morning. This is what happens every day in every court. It's largely what happens. A trial can be disruptive to the general routine of a courthouse. So I'm going to just tell you what a plea bargain even is, and because I've been using this word like you know what it is. It's actually a contract. It's a bargain. It's a contract. Two sides come together. There's negotiation before that contract. There's mutual benefit, and I'll explain what those are in just a minute. It's by no means legally required. There's no constitutional right to a plea bargain. There's no requirement of a plea bargain. It doesn't need to happen quickly. It doesn't need to happen ethically. There's just no regulation around it at all. But the reality is it happens most of the time. So the reason that... So what happens fundamentally is the prosecutor makes some offer and the defendant either takes it or rejects it. The prosecutor will say, okay, you're charged with robbery 2, we'll reduce that to theft 1, you'll go from 2 years to 1 year in prison, and everyone's basically not happy but satisfied, and they strike this deal. So reasons that the prosecutor would want to do it, I want to convince you that's not actually evil, what I'm talking about. It's just a thing. So one reason the prosecutors really like to do this is it saves a lot of time. Trials take, even a simple trial is going to take you 3 days. A long trial, the death penalty trials they just had, I mean, those were a year of just straight up trial time, never mind the lawyers and the court staff and the preparation. Plea bargain, to do a plea takes maybe 20 minutes in a courtroom, so it's just a lot faster. With the plea bargain, you don't need cops waiting around to testify, just sitting, they never show this on TV, the cop just parked in the hallway outside the courtroom waiting. On the public dollar. They don't need to bring witnesses in to testify, which can be quite traumatizing. I had a client once who, at the age of 10, testified against her father, and her entire family was physically lined up against her father. It was lined up behind her father against her. So it can be quite traumatizing for people. It can also just be a huge inconvenience. If you happen to see the car accident, now you're sucked into this. So you'd avoid all that with a plea bargain. This is a thing, I gave you a whole slide on this because this is a bit of a detour, but it outrages me so badly I wanted you to know about it. They're able to keep evidence secret that they would not otherwise be able to keep secret. Trials are public, and sometimes they want to bury evidence. One thing they are burying now, has anyone heard of the stingray? Do you know what the stingray is? Yes. Are you outraged? Yes. Okay. This is the thing that's going to be in the paper in a while from now, I hope. The stingray is something that the police departments are buying from the stingray manufacturer, some private company. They're able to track all cell phone calls in, like, Tacoma. Doesn't need any kind of warrant. If you drive through Tacoma, you talk on your cell phone, they've got your cell phone. They've got the metadata. They've got the actual conversation. They've got everything you don't want them to have. And with no suspicion of anything. It's just a huge dragnet. And it's utterly secret. They won't admit that they have it. Tacoma, it's come out because the ACLU's done some really good work, but there's no telling who else has it. Tacoma does have it, by the way. It's completely secret. They're required to sign a non-disclosure with the manufacturer. That non-disclosure says not only do you keep it private from, say, the defendant who's been arrested because of this evidence and is now on trial because of that evidence, you also keep it secret from judges and lawmakers and the public. And, in fact, the state agrees to, yes, dismiss a criminal case rather than disclose that they have this technology. I find this completely outrageous. I want everyone to know about this and be equally outraged. So in Florida, here's a case where a guy was charged with robbery. That's a real crime, robbery. And rather than admit they had this evidence, they reduced it to a misdemeanor. Guy pled out. He's got himself a misdemeanor. So that's one reason the state might want to plea bargain, is to keep evidence secret that they might not otherwise be able to keep secret. And a final reason is simply it's guaranteed. You know what the result's going to be. I mean, trial is always a gamble. You never quite know what the jury's going to do on either side. So with the plea bargain, it's guaranteed. So these are some reasons the state likes to plea bargain. Reasons the defense wants to plea bargain is, yes, they get a reduced charge generally, a reduced sentence, some real benefit to them. This is my slide for a job. They can be tailored to the defendant's particular circumstances. We're often doing what we call immigration safe plea bargains for immigrants, because just a little change in wording can make an enormous difference if they're an immigrant who might be facing deportation. It can make a difference in their job, their ability to keep their license. We can tailor things through a plea bargain that we can't do through a trial. Results are guaranteed. I mean, it's guaranteed guilty, but it's guaranteed. And actually, sometimes it's a guaranteed dismissal. It takes a lot less time. Now, here's the pleading guilty to get out of jail. If you go to trial, you need time to prepare for the trial. And there is a right to a speedy trial, but it doesn't mean you get to have it tomorrow. It means that you get to have it. In our state, usually it means within 60 days if you're in custody. And that can be extended, but usually 60 days is the rule. And we are way better in this state than other states. Louisiana, it's like a couple of years before they really get worried about it. So you're in custody the whole time. And, of course, you're in custody. You're in custody. That is awful. You're losing your job. You're not with your family. You know, your whole life is disrupted. Plus, you're worrying about what's going to happen with the trial. So this is where we get into people pleading guilty to get out of jail. It takes 60 days to get to trial. It might take a couple days to get to a plea. So we will plead them. We'll set a quick court date a couple days away. We'll do a plea. You know, if he gets arrested on Monday, we'll do a plea on Thursday, and he's done. He'll do 3 days jail, and that's it. Whereas if we go to trial, he's going to sit there for a few months if he can't get out of jail. So this is a reason a defendant would want to plead guilty. And this is what I was not able to explain to the 15-year-old, by the way, because 15-year-olds understand in custody or not in custody. They're very binary in my experience. And this leads to the Queen of Hearts, which seems absurd until you realize that's what we're doing. Sentence first, verdict afterwards. Guy does his sentence, and then maybe he gets found guilty or maybe he doesn't. But it's kind of a moot point at that point. He's done his sentence. The jail is over with at that point. This is enormously common. I think you may actually already understand this. This happens I mean, this is routine. It's abnormal when this doesn't happen, actually. So this is a system we have. This part I do think is bad. When I say about plea bargaining, I mean, plea bargaining I think is neutral, but this part I do think is bad. And this has a lot to do with pretrial detention and why they're locked up in the first place. And that's, frankly, a whole other topic, which was on the front page of the New York Times Magazine last weekend. So there, that is getting some press attention. It's a very interesting, difficult issue. So that is basically what a plea bargain is. Now, how does it actually work? This is a lawyer. This is me in this example. Here's how the plea bargain actually comes about. I'm a lawyer. I, for whatever reason, have this case. Here's my client. He's in jail, right? His life sucks. He snatched some lady's purse. I like robbery because I don't like robbery. Robbery is easy to charge in lots of different ways. Robbery means taking property by force. Taking property is, well, it can be shoplift, right? You steal a candy bar, a shoplift. If you steal something from a person's, from their person, then it's theft one, which is a felony, but it's still just a theft. Robbery two, you add in force. You take the candy bar, but you yank it out of the guy's hand, and he gets a bruise, and that's robbery, which truly they charge that as robbery. I know it doesn't seem like it might be robbery. It's also, you know, carjacking and, like, real crimes. And then there's robbery one, which means either someone was really badly injured or there was a weapon involved. So robbery, it's pretty easy to charge it lots of ways. And robbery one's a class A felony, which is the worst. And theft three is a misdemeanor, which is hardly even worth anyone's trouble. So here's a purse snatching. Guy's in jail because it's a purse snatching, basically. It's the sort of thing that gets a person locked up pre-trial because they're considered to be a danger to the community, and he might go snatch a purse again before this first trial comes up. So here's the situation. Now, this is what I do every day. Go to the prosecutor. Here's the prosecutor. Weighing the scales of justice. All the power, in my opinion, rests with the prosecutor here. It is entirely within the prosecutor's discretion whether to offer a plea bargain, what kind of plea bargain to offer, what factors to consider when offering it. Within their office, there are some policies and political considerations, but it's often that individual prosecutor's sense. And we care a lot about who the individual prosecutor is on any particular case. But it is their decision. They weigh what they want to weigh, and then they, you know, we have a negotiation. There really is horse trading. I mean, it's been called horse trading by the courts. You don't really want to watch it because it's... all my compassion and gentleness toward my client. I don't get mean toward my client, but I get a lot. My humor becomes a lot darker when I'm talking to the prosecutor, in a way that I really don't think my clients would appreciate hearing. But I have to ingratiate myself with the prosecutors. You know, I have to, and they're ingratiating themselves with me. It does go two ways, but it is a negotiation. It all happens in their office. It's all behind closed doors. There's no oversight to it at all. Eventually they make an offer, I take it to my client. I want to be clear, I think this is a misconception. The lawyer has no say in whether a client actually takes a plea bargain or goes to trial. It is absolutely not my decision. I cannot control it. It is the client's constitutional right whether to go to trial or whether to plead guilty. And so only he can exercise his constitutional right. So I advise him, and sometimes lawyers are really lean on him. I'm pretty much like, just pick one and we'll deal with either one. But anyway, I take it back to the client. He decides. If he doesn't like it, I go back to the prosecutor, and that just keeps going. What also can happen, the threat that's hanging over a client often is, I just made this little picture get bigger, a larger charge. We defense attorneys call it the trial penalty. The prosecutors hate that phrase. They deny that it exists. What a trial penalty means is, say you're charged with robbery too, but say, you know, the person you snatched the purse from got an injury. Well, is it a big enough injury to justify a robbery one? Good question. I don't know. They charge it as robbery two. But if he goes to trial, they'll charge as robbery one, and we'll let a jury decide which one it is. So by setting the case for trial, they are often risking a higher charge. In juvenile court, by setting the case for trial, they are very often risking a higher charge that will send them to adult court automatically, which is a huge disincentive to going to trial in juvenile court. And my personal pet peeve, because that's been the subject of legislation lately to try and get rid of that rule, and I want that rule to go away. Anyway, so the charge will often go up if the person does go to trial. So we reach a negotiation, and eventually we find something that the defendant can live with in 97% of cases. Now, I want you to think about the two things that are missing from this process I've just explained to you. The first is a judge. remember, the overseer of the entire criminal justice system, the elected officials that are charged with being neutral, they are nowhere in this entire process. They will see the contract once it's presented in court. It does eventually land in court. There's a plea hearing and a sentencing hearing. They can deny the plea bargain. They cannot go along with it. But as a practical matter, they almost always do, because they know if they don't, the entire process grinds to a halt. They're looking at a whole bunch of trials. So the reality is, by the time they see it, it's a done deal anyway, and they do tend to generally go along with it. But they are absolutely nowhere part of the plea bargain. The other person who's not in this process particularly is the defendant. Now, he gets to say yes or no to the result that I bring to him, but he is not watching the negotiation. He has no idea if his lawyer is actually arguing for him. He often suspects his lawyer is not arguing for him. There's generally a pretty wide gulf between client and lawyer. There's economic gulf. There's often a racial issue. I mean, I'm white. I have lots of black clients who don't particularly trust me simply on my skin color. There's an education gap. I mean, there's a lot of mistrust that can come up between client and lawyer. So when I go off to some room behind some other, you know, white, privileged, educated prosecutor, and we have a little confab, and I come back and say, okay, well, 1 year or go to trial on Rob One, they have no idea where that just came from. They have no insight into it. So these are the two people missing from that process. As a result of plea bargaining, you can imagine that anyone who gets arrested is going to end up with some kind of conviction. This stat came out a few years ago, the National Employment Law Project. More than one in four U.S. adults, more than one in four U.S. adults have some kind of arrest or conviction. And most of those arrests are convictions, eventually. More than one in four. That's a huge statistic. This affects everybody. This is, of course, every DUI, every sex case, every murder case, every, you know, big juicy case you thought of, but also sort of the run-of-the-mill shoplifts and the bar fights and the, you know, sort of the regular cases. But it's one in four. If you're caught up in that process, you're going to end up with a conviction. This quote is from a brief that, as I was preparing for this, actually landed in a brief from a prosecutor that I got on a case. I couldn't believe how apropos it was. We were talking about sentencing. He said the respondent, the client, is having weapons and burglary charges dismissed as part of this plea deal. But it does not mean those offenses did not happen. Just because they were dismissed, not even not guilty at trial, dismissed. The prosecutor said, we are not pursuing these. Just because they were dismissed doesn't mean it didn't happen. Knowing factually what actually happened in those cases, they didn't happen. He was falsely accused, and that was a good reason for them to dismiss. But here's a prosecutor trying to use the fact that he was charged to get the guy a higher sentence. That's just me saying this really does happen. And here's the consequences of a conviction. All right, jail, of course. You all know that. Money, usually a fine. There's not just a fine. There's court costs. There's an attorney recoupment fee. There's a thing called a confinement fee. They charge you for your jail time. There's a thing called a conviction fee, $43 just for getting convicted in Seattle Municipal Court. There's something like 29 fees that get tacked on in addition to a fine. You also pay interest on those fines, and you pay that while you're incarcerated, and you can't be paying it anyway, so the interest accumulates. When you get out of prison or jail, you're usually looking at a huge bill. You can't pay the bill. No one ever pays the bill. That's the reality. And so what you have instead is just a ruined credit score. You also have trouble finding work because they ask you if you've ever been convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor, and you have to say yes. So it's harder to find work. It's harder to find housing. Some convictions will get you booted out of Section 8 housing. Landlords don't look favorably on quite a few of these convictions. It can get you disqualified from certain federal benefits, including temporary aid to needy families, which is to say welfare. Or food stamps. This is an actual food stamp. It can get you barred from certain licensing. If I get myself a felony, I'm not going to be a lawyer any longer. And there's lots of other convictions that can get you booted out of whatever licensing requirements you've met. The way the licensing works is if you get, like if I were to get disbarred, I'm not then going to become a cosmetologist because once you are booted from one licensing requirement, it's very difficult to get a new one. And not just in this state, but in any other state. You also have trouble getting back into school, not so much getting admitted, but getting money, getting financing for school. Some convictions can bar financial aid, not all, but like a drug conviction and financial aid, that's a hard thing to pull off. You can't go to Canada. I love this one. Canada doesn't like criminals, and I think it's the only country, but it happens to be the country next door. If you have a DUI, believe me, you are not going to Canada. Just you're not going. And there's lots of, you can get there eventually, but it takes several years. You're probably going to lose your driver's license. You might lose a security clearance. Of course you're going to lose a security clearance, or you're not going to get one in the future. You're not going to maybe be able to join the Army or the military, which also in part because you can't possess a gun in almost all instances. So you can't really be a good soldier if you can't possess a gun. You might lose your right to vote and change these laws. You might lose your right to be on a jury. You might have immigration consequences if you're not a U.S. citizen. And not just, you know, the illegal immigrants we hear about. But, I mean, if you have a green card, if you are even, it's in some cases, rare cases, a naturalized citizen. The Nazi guard who got deported, he was a naturalized citizen. That's not the usual case. The usual case is you're going to face some sort of immigration consequence as a result of a conviction if you're not a, you know, born in the U.S., United States citizen. And you might also lose time with your children. You might even lose your rights, your parental rights. So these are actually some of the consequences of a criminal conviction. I'm showing you this to say there are huge consequences to what we're doing here, all based on this plea bargaining. Here's what I call a choice. So this is the choice that comes out of this horse trading. You can either plead guilty or plead guilty. It's your choice. You can plead guilty or be found guilty. Some people really do get found not guilty, or they really do. This plea bargaining leads to a dismissal of the charge. So that can happen. It's just that once the charge is dismissed, it might be held against them anyway. So what I am saying is that there are... what we are doing is simply not having all these trials. We are not establishing a system that actually is designed to separate the wheat from the chaff, the sheep from the goats. We are not designing a system that takes it to a jury of 12 independent citizens and says, you know, figure it out. Did this happen or not? Is there reasonable doubt? We're simply not doing that. What we're really doing is sending two lawyers into a room and handicapping a case, a trial that will never happen, assessing whether they're going to win or not. This is by two lawyers who, in general, have not been to trial in several years. I have not been to trial in 3 years, 2 years. And that's not at all unusual. I know one attorney who's not been to trial in like 15 years. Other people go to trial all the time. It's kind of a macho thing to do, so they like to do it. But they're working in like a death penalty case. Those are generally going to go to trial. But not your average kind of run-of-the-mill juvie misdemeanor kind of low-level felony case. So we have this system where we say that we've got guilty and innocent, but in fact we have these results that say he might be guilty. He's probably innocent. There's like a 10% chance he's guilty, or there's a 50% chance they're innocent. We're really kind of laying odds, and then we're striking a contract that reflects those odds. And then we are imposing kind of a binary guilty or not guilty based on what's really scalar. I mean, it's actually a continuum, and we're just assigning this arbitrary binary result, and then we're attaching all these consequences to it, to the guilty. And there's also consequences to dismissal, because I don't think, you know, there's a lot of people upset about George Zimmerman and O.J. Simpson and John Gotti and the other people who, I think there's popular opinion, got away with something. So there's consequences both ways. So what I'm saying is just not that it's good or bad, but what I'm saying is this is what's happening. This is the system. It is a system of pleas. And if we're going to have a criminal justice system, we either need to fundamentally change how we're approaching that system, or we need to accept this is a system we've got. This is what these results actually mean. That's all I have. Thank you. Questions, comments, discussion, outrage, joy, silence? Yes.
All right, so you said several times that you weren't opposed to plea bargaining and that it wasn't necessarily a negative thing. I don't think you made a super convincing case that's actually true. Are you saying that the plea bargaining process itself is positive, but that we then need to look at the consequences of a conviction differently? And if so, what are you actually suggesting should be done?
I don't know what should be done, first of all, and I struggled with whether I had to come up with the answer for this talk, and I decided no. In terms of plea bargaining being bad, when I was in law school, there was a young woman who was in school with me who wanted every case to go to trial. And I've heard some people argue for that. Just send every case to trial, forget about plea bargaining, let the jury decide every single case. And that's kind of idealistically appealing. And then there's an idea, I think, that plea bargains are basically the bad guy getting away with it. You know, okay, well, he did this horrible thing, but now they cut him a deal and he's just going to go walk the streets. I don't think that particularly happens, and I don't think that process is a bad one. I don't want to see every case go to trial. I'm not arguing for that. I do think there's a lot of reasons why the process of reaching this contract is a good one. What I think is flawed is that we are assigning a binary result, guilty or not guilty. We are assigning that based on this horse trading process, when in fact the horse trading is basically laying odds. Are they going to win the trial? 75% chance the state's going to win. Let's say this, you know, some cases the state has like DNA evidence and a confession and it's all in video and there's 17 witnesses and they're all independent. They're going to win that trial. So, and we know that, and they've got like a 99% chance of winning it. And that's going to say, okay, well then he's going to plead guilty as charged. He's not getting much of a break. Other people, you know, okay, there's one witness and he's a crack addict and he was, you know, stoned that day and the cop is a known liar and there's just not much to it. We're not going to get there, so we'll offer you a misdemeanor. Well, it doesn't mean the crime is any different. What happened, happened. But when one instance it gets pled out as like a robbery and the other it's a theft, I'm saying what the reason is that it reflects this scalar, this odds-laying process without acknowledging that it's really just laying the odds. Does that make sense? Okay, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
I'm just curious how this plays out on racial grounds. You mentioned a little bit about the relationship between the client and the lawyer, but in general, what impact do you think this is having?
Oh, it's everywhere. So I don't believe anyone wants it to break along racial grounds. I really don't. And I can believe there are members of racial minorities who do not believe that. In fact, I'm positive it's true. But there have been numerous studies here in this state, including good old liberal Seattle, that say that the race of the defendant affects every stage of the criminal justice. This won't surprise you guys. It affects whether the police are even in their neighborhood to begin with, whether the police stop them, whether the police search them, arrest them, all of that is affected by race. Then it comes to the prosecutor's office, and we do know that the race of the defendant matters in charging decisions. No prosecutor I know wants that to be true. No prosecutor I know wants that to be true. And the fact is, it is true. We also know that it affects how the case is ultimately disposed of, and how it's disposed of does matter in part their rapport with their own attorney, because the attorney's own racism can be a factor. It's true. If I see a black kid, I think, oh yeah, that should probably resolve as a robbery. If I see a white kid, oh yeah, he's probably resolved as a theft one. And I'm not trying to do that. I'm pretty actively trying to not do that, frankly, as are all the defense attorneys I know. But you have to make sure you're resisting it. And then when it comes to sentencing, we know that the race of the defendant matters for sentencing purposes. So this is one of the reasons why the racial disparity is quite extreme, including extreme right here in good old liberal Seattle, or, you know, down the road. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry, this woman actually was next, I think.
I assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in general your juvenile population would have a higher ACE score, adverse childhood experience score, be more exposed to mental illness and violence and so forth, and deprivation.
Oh, yes.
And early deprivation, early trauma exposure leads to certain fixed ideas about your own guilt and worth and so forth. I wonder about, and just as an average person, the law thinks differently from how we people out here think. You may not know that, but
we know that. I have heard. I went to law school to be brainwashed.
And so it doesn't make any, you know, it doesn't make the same kind of logical sense
right.
to us. So if you combine all of that, I'm really wondering about the reality of informed consent, about your client's capacity to make meaningful decisions.
Oh, I wonder about that too, every day. And I'm right in the middle of it. Oh, my gosh.
Could you talk some about how you deal with that?
Oh, I cry.
I mean, I think on the one hand, I would think they should just hang on to your hand and trust you because you know.
No.
But that's not informed consent.
No, because I won't hang on to their hand in return. I'm not allowed to exercise their constitutional rights for them. They hate that. It's very difficult. That's a talk in itself. I personally have grave doubts whether a court system is appropriate for any child. And that's not me being good-hearted. Oh, we need to save children. It's like, this just simply makes no sense to me. Children do not understand what's happening. They just don't get it. And they're not equipped to learn it, particularly. They understand if they're in jail or not. They totally get that. And they understand about being punished. And you're right, 99% of them come to me with these high A scores, the adverse childhood experience. And it does affect how they perceive. It certainly affects, you know, they're just waiting to be punished. What can I say? I make sort of a dark joke of yourself. We call it competency. What you're calling informed consent, I would call competency, which is your ability to understand what's happening. We get like adults who are just have full-on mental illness. They are not living in the same world with the rest of us. And in extreme cases, they can be deemed incompetent. They just can't assist their lawyer. They don't understand the charges. This process makes no sense. When that comes up with kids, you know, I really think it's just about every kid who just simply doesn't understand what's happening, despite my very best efforts. I mean, I had a kid once, I was about to plead her guilty, and I was explaining to her with the constitutional rights she was giving up by pleading guilty. And she says to me, what's a constitutional right? And I said, well, it's a right that's guaranteed under the Constitution. It's your birthright. It's sort of a thing you're born with. She said, what's a constitution? This is the population. I had to explain. I mean, believe me, I had a copy in her hands by the next day. And I had to explain. She goes, oh, I love this. She said, is that the thing they all signed? And I was able to say, no, it's the other one, actually. Just a couple weeks ago, there was a judge who was out. He was on jury duty, of all things. A sitting judge was on jury duty, and which disrupted his calendar. And one of the kids asked me, she goes, what's a jury? They just have the basic information they don't have. And when I try to explain pleading guilty, get out of jail, they don't get it. And about holding my hand, some kids definitely want to just hand it all over to me, the adult. Partly I think that's not good because I think I am in no way their parent, and I need that needs to be perfectly clear to them because I can fall into a parental role, especially given that some of their parents are not very good parents. And I'm kind to them, and it can create a false expectation. But also that if they're going to be in a court system, it is part of my responsibility to make sure that they are exercising their own rights, that they are making their own decisions, even as a 14-year-old understands that decision. The law understands 14-year-olds make decisions differently than 34-year-olds, but it is their decision. So I cannot just hold their hand. I've had clients say, just tell me what to do. And I might couch it as, well, you know, I think it might be your best move to do X, but I can't decide for you. And I might not answer the question at all. Yeah, it's tough. Yes. Okay. This guy and then this woman in front, I think.
There's a general sense that the United States justice system is unique in how adversarial it is, and that sort of other places in the world have, I guess maybe it's a more judge-centric or a more kind of seeking out the truth rather than the two sides sort of going at it. And if you could sort of comment on how our system and our plea bargaining system compares to the rest of the world.
So I don't know I know some about other legal systems. Ours, of course, began in Britain. And there's a whole continental tradition and whatever's going on in Asia. I mean, there's wildly different traditions. It's different. Like, say, in France, they have the constitutional system. I don't know a whole lot about French law, but, you know, they have a judge who is more like a prosecutor. They really investigate the case. This happens in Spain. It happens throughout continental Europe. And whereas in Britain and America and all the, you know, Australia, all the countries that come out of Britain, it's supposed to be adversarial. It's this kind of 18th century idea that if you let the marketplace of ideas hold forth and everyone has their say, then the truth will come out. I have my own suspicions. I really don't think that works, actually. But that makes me not a very traditional lawyer, because believe me, they teach you in law school that that's exactly how people think. So I think in other systems, they're more concerned with they're more openly concerned with negotiation. They're like, I think Japan, I'm always hearing, Japan doesn't have all these trials, but they have a whole elaborate system of negotiation that comes in before you ever get to trial. Whereas we just kind of go right to litigation. Culturally, and I think that really is just how we're set up. So I don't know if that's much of an answer, but I think they're doing the same problem solving and the same repair of society that we're trying to do, but they're doing it, they acknowledge more readily that they're doing it behind closed doors through negotiation, whereas we pretend that we're doing it through this marketplace of ideas when we're not. Yeah. Was there one more? Yeah.
Hi. Just a quick comment on the last question. It seems that the adversarial nature of the system would lead people who aren't equipped for self-advocacy to be crushed. And my question is more process-oriented, which is, how many of these plea bargains lead to conviction versus dismissals, and how would a dismissal happen?
Dismissals happen sometimes because the state just doesn't have the evidence. The wrong guy got arrested, and that becomes clear, and they just don't have the evidence, and they're willing to say they don't have the evidence. Other ways dismissals happen, let's say in a DUI, this is pretty common. DUI, there's a thing called a deferred prosecution, and if you agree to go to treatment and stay out of trouble for 2 years and don't have any more DUIs for a couple of years, then at the end of that 2 years, your case will be dismissed. And there's similar resolutions, stipulated order of continuance. We say, yes, I did this crime, but give me a year to prove I won't do it again, and then I'll come back and you'll dismiss it. There's lots and lots of arrangements we make like that. But many of those, like for immigration purposes, many of those count as guilty pleas, even when the result is a dismissal. We have to be very careful with immigrants about things like that. And what shows up on the rap sheet later, which is all we ever get later, is like a DM, you know, like charge, cause number, DM, dismissal. And you don't know why. You don't know why, well, because of they didn't have the evidence, the guy didn't do it, the search was horrifically terrible and never should have been brought into court, or they worked some sort of deal where I'll stay out of trouble for a couple of years, I'm so sorry, I won't do it again. We never know actually how the dismissal came about, which I think is what this prosecutor was trying to say. Well, just because he got dismissed doesn't mean he didn't do it. That guy didn't do it. I'm telling you, that one particular case, that guy didn't do it. They come about in just a variety. And in terms of the percentage, it's not a high percentage. The dismissals, I would say, they're going to be higher in misdemeanor court because they're more readily do these treatment and then dismiss things in misdemeanor court, not at all in felonies. And limited in juvenile. I would say my guess is something like 10 to 20% would result in dismissals somehow. I'm not even sure it's that high. The vast majority, if you have a really great like robbery case, if really good, you're going to win it. I mean, I had one where they ripped off the drug dealer, okay, and the drug dealer did not want to come to court to testify. Plus, the drug dealer started the whole thing, and that was pretty clear. Well, the prosecutor didn't really want to be defending the rights of drug dealers, particularly, so they offered a misdemeanor. So that's the more common. If you have a great case, they'll offer the misdemeanor generally before they'll offer a dismissal. Not always. I've gotten wonderful dismissals. But generally, they'll get to a misdemeanor, and that's sort of their, we're sorry, go away, this is over. Okay, this is over too. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this podcast of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. If you liked what you heard, you might leave a good review. It'll help other listeners find us. Kelly Vomacka is a criminal defense lawyer with extensive knowledge of how plea deals work. She spoke at the 7th Annual Smoke Farm Symposium on Saturday, August 22nd, 2015. Check out our website, kuow.org/speakersforum, for other great talks. For Speakers Forum, KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm John O'Brien.